Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's called Common Core, but these new set of standards attached to the federal race to the top funds is drawing fiery criticism from conservatives to liberals and from educators and parents. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In 2010, Maryland was awarded $240 million for the federal race to the top funds. And part of the criteria is adopting an accountability system based on the Common Core standards to assure graduates are college or career ready. But the problems in opposition is already popping up. Some criticize the standardization of the testing, some the swiftness of the implementation, and others the technological challenges and the cost of the program. Take a look at the issues swirling around this hot educational issue. In our studio is John Andis, who is an instructor in the Education of Specialties Department here at Salisbury University, and also Betty Willer. She is president of the Maryland State Education Association. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, I'm going to start with you, and why don't you try to go through a little bit about an explanation about what these Common Core standards are and how did people come up with them? What was the impetus? Because obviously they've been tied to the race to the top money.
I think it's important, Don, that we define the word standards. Standards in this context means what is to be taught or what students should be able to know and should be able to do. And as opposed to curriculum is how it's going to be taught, which is curriculum is the lessons, the unit plans, those kinds of things. So standards are what does a student need to know and be able to do, and curriculum is how it's to be taught. Unit plans, lesson plans, objectives, those kinds of things, daily instructional activities. So for many years, states and local government systems decided what students would be able to know, be able to do, at each grade level or what needed to be taught. And the standards varied from state to state, and in some cases from school system to school system. As a result of some international and national assessments or test results, such as college remediation statistics and trends in international mathematics and science program for international students assessment, a movement began to increase the rigor of curriculum, and an outcome of the movement was to explore the possibility of creating national standards. So the National Governors Association in the spring of 2009 formed the Common Core Standards Initiative, and the Council of Chief State School Officers and the National Governors Association committed to creating a set of national or shared educational standards. And at that time, 48 states, Washington, D.C., participated in the process of creating national education standards. And advisory experts to the process included the ACT, the College Board, the National Association of State Boards of Education, and subject area organizations such as the National Councils of Teachers of English and the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics. And finally, in June of 2010, the Common Core Standards were published, and the Common Core Standards were adopted by the Maryland State Board of Education in June of 2011 as the state standards.
Well, let me ask you this. We had these standards, they're being developed, and now that we're getting the situation where they're being adopted, what's your assessment, at least overall, in terms of how they're being adopted and how this is working?
Well, within the state of Maryland itself, I assume we're referring to the state of Maryland and adoption in the state of Maryland. In June of 2011, the State Board of Education adopted the state standards in the state of Maryland. Then each school system was charged with creating the local curriculum. At the same time, the Maryland State Department of Education was doing a crosswalk. That is comparing the existing Maryland state curriculum to the Common Core standards and finding out where there were gaps, and to identify those gaps and to develop lessons, unit plans, those kinds of things, to identify where the gaps are, what needed to be changed, and so forth and so on. And if listeners or viewers go to mdk12.org, they can see a document that crosswalks you between the Common Core standards, the old Maryland State curriculum, and the difference between the two. So those resources are available for people to take a look at.
Penny Willer is the president of the Maryland State Education Association. Penny, what is your assessment, first, of the concept of these Common Core, and then also how do you see in terms of the development, in terms of actually implementing these things? I mean, because your teachers are like on the front lines. I mean, they're the ones who have to actually implement this. It's fine for us to draw up a lot of nice, you know, graphs and ideas and broad concepts. How do you assess how this is being implemented?
Well, I think it's fair to say in education we've always had standards, and we've been through several waves of education reform in Maryland. This is what they call the third wave, which we have affectionately called a tsunami of education reform, because usually when we do ed reform, we're not doing everything at once. Right. We're either adjusting standards, or we're adjusting curriculum, or we're adjusting assessments. And we haven't for a long time adjusted teacher evaluations, but now we're doing all of those things at once. And while I'm hearing from teachers around the state of Maryland as well as the country that they think the Common Core standards are good, they are having real issues with the implementation of these standards. The curriculum is being developed as we are implementing the standards, and teachers like to have curriculum more than a week ahead of time. The assessments are still being developed, so we're not sure yet exactly what they look like. Teacher evaluations are being changed, and teachers are a little worried about that because these new evaluations are going to contain a portion of student growth measures, which include test scores. And we all know that when we switch to a new assessment, scores drop. So teachers are concerned not only that all of this is still in flux, but that they're going to be judged on scores that are going to be diminishing for a while. So I think I've said before, if you look 5, 6, 7 years down the road, I think Maryland's going to be in a good place, but I think we're going to be going over a bumpy road for the next couple of years.
We're also joined, I believe, by Kelly Stevenson with the Wicomico County Education Association. So Kelly, we've been sort of describing a bit about the concept of the Common Core. Just in first blush, what is your own sense about these standards, how legitimate they are, and certainly their implementation? I mean, I guess your folks, as I mentioned, with the Maryland Teachers Association, you guys are the first people on the ground. I mean, you guys will have to carry out all these ideas.
Well, it's not necessarily the standards themselves. Some subject areas would say that they have been doing a lot of things that these standards require already. However, I think Betty is correct in what she's saying, what's happening on the state level, but how that's affecting teachers and students and principals as well on the local levels does deal with the implementation. Teachers do not feel completely prepared. As Betty stated, she describes it as tsunami of education reform because there are a lot of other factors that have been pressed upon us with the new curriculum. Some teachers feel that the Common Core curriculum basically tells them how to teach in some subject areas. That's what I'm hearing. But it really deals with the preparedness, the lack of attention to professional development, which is also tied to funding. We have to realize that, you know, monies to adopt Race to the Top and the Common Core standards have already been issued out to local counties. And that money's basically gone. So the question is, how do we maintain these reforms without adequate funding?
John, I'll turn to you. So is this just a problem of the way it's getting implemented? I mean, is that much of the criticism certainly coming from, say, for instance, teachers? I mean, I was running across where I think it was that, as a matter of fact, the Maryland State Education Association found that 2/3 of educators felt that they were unprepared to teach the new curriculum. I mean, is it just a matter of what we're moving too quickly? Although it seems, I think, these things should have been adopted over at least the last few years. So it seems as if we've had some time, but, I mean, what's going on here?
I think both Betty and Kelly make excellent points. And that is, when you implement new curriculum or new standards, you have choices. You can typically implement them in a grade band. Let's say implement them in primary grade level. So you start out pre-K through first grade, let's say. Then the following year, you implement second grade through fourth grade and so forth and so on. So as the class moves up, they're exposed to the new Common Core. So school systems have an opportunity to address any specific issues that occur. So one way of implementing it is to use grade bands and implementing it over an extended period of time to extend the period of time to address Betty, both Betty and Kelly's concern, which is resource concern. Time, money, and resources, staff development, training, those kinds of things. Currently, what Maryland is doing is implementing it all at once. That is, we're going to implement it from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, and we're going to do it. As Betty and Kelly have pointed out, we're moving to an assessment program that will be implemented, trial assessment this year on the park assessment, and the following year the assessments will actually count. So what Maryland has decided to do is use implementation all at once, all the way from kindergarten through 12th grade, as opposed to what Betty and Kelly, I believe, are advocating, which is let's look at, take our time, implement it grade bands at a time, making sure we have the correct resources in place to support our teachers as they go about the business of helping our students meet these new higher rigorous standards.
Now, you were in the education system. If you were still in your position, would this give you pause?
Yes.
I mean,
yes, because as a superintendent of schools and being in public education in Maryland for 38 years, I have seen many changes in public education in the state of Maryland during those 38 years. All the way back from when I first began teaching, we had something called Project Basic. And I see Betty shaking her head, so she recognizes Project Basic, all the way through the Maryland School Performance Assessment Program to the MSA and so forth and so on. So I have personally experienced as a classroom teacher and as a leader in the school system those implementations of those changes. Ideally, we would advocate for let's take our time and implement slowly to make sure we have the necessary resources in place so we can support teachers as they implement the new standards. Maryland has not chosen to do that.
But how does this compare to the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind, in which they emphasize standards? Some criticism has been, certainly from an ideological point of view, that this is simply just a stepchild of No Child Left Behind. We're all still talking about standards, and we're not really talking about teaching kids. What's your assessment of that
critique? Well, I think with No Child Left Behind, there were some unrealistic expectations. Everybody was going to be proficient by 2014, which is statistically impossible. I mean, we have different programs for different students because the students are different, because they're not all going to achieve at the same level. With Common Core, it's a set of standards that have been internationally benchmarked. They were developed with educators. And I think many teachers, and Kelly indicated this as well, many teachers don't have a problem with standards. We've always had standards. We want our students to reach high standards. The problem is you're changing a whole lot of things at once. And when you do that, both teachers and administrators, school-based administrators, need professional development. Common Core requires a whole different teaching pedagogy. And so if you were not prepared to teach in that way, then you have to retool yourself. Even if you were, it might have been a long time since you've done it. So we need professional development for teachers on how to teach the Common Core way, if you will. We need professional development to develop the curriculum. We need professional development on the assessments, the type of assessments that students are going to do. We need professional development on the new teacher evaluations and what's going to be expected of teachers with regard to the professional practice part of it, as well as the student growth part of it. And, you know, teachers are trying to do their day job at the same time. They're trying to teach like they always do. So we're asking an enormous amount of people who are already giving an enormous amount, and we're doing it in a very, very abbreviated time frame.
Well, let's get down a little bit in terms of what are they asking you to do differently in terms of teaching that you weren't, say, doing before? Is there like a particular way of teaching?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Some people say that before we were teaching a mile wide and, you know, 4 inches deep, now we're going to do a half a mile wide and 4 feet deep. So we're going to ask students to look for evidence. We're going to ask them to problem solve more. We're going to ask them to do critical thinking, which is probably what we should have been doing all along, but it's something that we got away from. You know, I've been teaching a long time, and I think early on we were teaching that way and with new ideas. You know, in education, A friend of mine used to say, we're always looking for the newest, latest, greatest, right way to do it. And I think sometimes that takes us off course. Now we're trying to get back to where we should be. So we're going to get there. And teachers and administrators are working very, very hard to do that. But the load on them right now is almost overbearing.
Kelly, what about that? About the teaching and the way different that you teach, and how does that differing in term different in terms of the way you teach fit into standardized tests? I mean, when you talk about critical thinking and so on and so forth, that's not the same as you know, checking off the box of a multiple choice test. I mean, how do those two fit together in your mind?
Well, there's a lot of factors that are going on right now in terms of the Common Core, where you have students with a wide range of abilities placed in the same class. So that requires more for the teacher, because you have students at the top who basically probably have the skills to have advanced learning, and then you have students at the bottom. Maybe some of them are in special education or what have you. So it requires the teacher to differentiate their instruction to meet the needs of all students in their classes. One thing to point out, because you were asking about the difference between No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, is the testing accountability, where No Child Left Behind was more of a accountability on the school as a whole, where Race to the Top is individual accountability, where these teachers will be held accountable for the performance of their students on the standardized testing. So we have to take that into consideration too. And, you know, I think we could have a whole entire conversation about testing and its impact on instruction and, you know, how that comes out. But I would point out that piece, because that puts a lot more pressure on the individual teacher to meet the needs of all the students in their classes, presenting things in the manner and using techniques associated with Common Core. And the most teachers out there would say that, yes, every child learns differently. So to put everyone under one umbrella is just not a realistic way of approaching instruction.
Now, I remember when I was going through public school years ago, but public school, there were like these, until I guess high school, well, even sometimes in high school, I guess, there were like these like tests you took, and mm-hmm. then you would like, they put you in certain classes so that whatever your talents were, whatever your achievement scores were, would then like match a bunch of others. Is that not being done now? I mean, because she seems to be pointing to a problem where you've got a bunch of different people or a bunch of different types of students in a class, and then she's got to like teach to everybody. I mean,
Don, it depends on the school system.
Okay.
Each school system uses a different process to identify students for specific courses, whether students are identified for gifted and talented programs or other types of programs. So it really depends upon the school system. When you and I were in school, we took what was called a norm reference test. It was probably the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. And in fact, you probably remember your teacher saying you could only use a number 2 pencil, you couldn't make any stray marks, and when you got to the stop sign, the booklet stopped. That was a typical norm reference test. In other words, my test result and your test result was compared to everyone else. So as a consequence, there were students who did very well and students who did average and students who didn't do so well. And some school systems use those norm reference tests to determine whether or not to place a student in certain programs. Some school systems today still use norm reference tests, but this is a significant different type of test that we're moving into.
Right.
Schools and states are either adopting the PARC, which is the Partnership for College and Career Readiness, which is going to be used in Maryland, or Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium, which is going to be used in the state of Delaware. Those are no longer norm reference tests. Those are criterion reference tests.
And what's the difference between the two?
The difference between the two is on a norm reference test, when you and I took the Iowa Test of Basic Skills of the California, your score would be compared to my score.
Mm-hmm.
And since you're much smarter than I am, and you probably did much better than I did, your score would be much higher because we're comparing all of our scores. Criterion reference test, my results are compared against a standard or a criterion, not against each other. So a norm reference test is really the old bell curve.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Criterion reference test, I'm compared to whether or not I actually was able to gain that standard, whatever that standard happens to be. So as Kelly has pointed out, we're not only moving to a different type of testing system, but we're also moving to a different type of accountability, which has created a tremendous amount of anxiety among educators. And as Kelly has pointed out, under the old MSA system, the current testing system we're under, schools and school systems were held accountable. Under the new PARC assessment, school systems and individual teachers will be held accountable, and those individual test scores will become a part of the overall teacher and principal evaluation.
So Betty, if I'm a teacher, and not only is the system going to be evaluated by how are they being, but as an individual teacher, I mean, you never know what, you know, the composition of the children, the students you're going to get. I mean, what kind of pressure does that put on you, and what kind of strategies do you have to deal with that uncertainty?
I think it puts a lot of pressure on a teacher, because you're right, you don't know what your class makeup is going to be. There are going to be years when you're going to have a terrific bunch of kids that do really well and are highly motivated, and then there may be times when you have kids who are not quite so intellectually gifted and motivated. So it requires the teacher to really be able to recognize that and come up with a variety of strategies to deal with it. I think that good teachers don't mind being held accountable, but when you talk about using a test score over which you don't have complete control, I've often said I teach science, and in science we teach students that unless you can control all of the variables in an experiment, you don't know which one made the difference. And we don't know, you know, if a child comes to school not feeling well, or if mom and dad had a fight the night before, or if your best friend said, I don't like you. I mean, there are any number of things that could impact a child's performance on any given day. And face it, a test is really a snapshot of what a child is doing on that particular day.
Kelly, what about that? What about, I mean, what if you're sitting in the classroom, when you're sitting in the classroom, what kind of pressure do you feel in terms of the accountability that there is? I mean, what do you do?
Well, I think the most challenging things for educators to, realize is that you are being held accountable. So the difficulty comes in with, as Betty stated, factors that really teachers have no control over that do contribute to how well or how successful a student is with their education. I would say that a lot of times teachers get frustrated when they can't motivate a student to engage in the lessons and develop an interest for the content. There's only so much a teacher can do, and it really is left up to the student to determine their own responsibility in regards to education, and I would say parents as well. So there is a feeling that, well, we're the only ones held accountable, you know. How about the student themselves or the parents? And then we also have other factors, and I do have to point this out, the new discipline regulations that have been passed down from MSDE, which will make it more difficult to suspend students and issue discipline. So that will play a role too, because teachers feel that they're not going to be supported in terms of the classroom environment and the success of the students. So there's a lot of factors that are involved. I do want to point out too, because I'm a special education teacher, and I applaud MSEA for their latest article that they had sent out in the newsletter about IEPs and the Common Core, because there is no curriculum for special education with the new curriculum. So that's even more challenging for teachers who are also trying to meet the needs of these IEPs, and considering all the other factors, it is very, very overwhelming. And you see a lot of anxiety, as was stated before, pressure. And to be honest, speaking with novice teachers, they're not sure if this is something that they would want to continue doing as we move along. So as this goes along, it will also be interesting to look at the retention levels of teachers and, how, it fluctuates in and out every single year.
John, as superintendent, is this fair to teachers?
As a former superintendent of schools, you're asking me, is it fair to teachers?
This idea that the people, that you have these tests, and now you have these students, a mix of students, is at least at this point, and you are accountable for factors that they're talking about, for instance, whether it's the motivation of the student, whether it's the involvement of the parents, and there's obviously the impact of the economic and social side of this as well. I mean, all those factors are like put into the mix. Is it fair then to say, okay, you as an individual, for whatever reasons, you didn't meet the standards, and therefore you're held accountable? I mean, is it fair?
Well, I think, Don, it's important for listeners to understand that the state of Maryland has had a history of accountability and testing.
Okay.
We began with MSPAP. Well, actually, it all began in 1984 mm-hmm. with the Nation at Risk, when President Ronald Reagan developed the Nation at Risk, and the Secretary of Education was Secretary Terrence Bell. And that report from President Reagan basically said that public education was failing. At the same time, in 1989, the governor at the time, Governor Schaefer, appointed Walter Sondheim to do a similar report on the state of Maryland. And at that point in time, the Sondheim Commission said, no, we're not doing what we need to do for students in public schools in the state of Maryland, and recommended that a process of accountability for schools and school systems be put in place. So consequently, the state of Maryland developed MSPAP, which was introduced in the early 1990s, about 1992, 93, somewhere in that time period. So Maryland has had testing probably since 1994 until the present. So we've been a state that's been involved in testing, and as a result of that, we're one of the top-ranked school systems in the United States of America as a result of the accountability process, the leadership we have in the school systems, as well as the phenomenal teachers that we have in our schools. So in terms of the new PARC assessments, which haven't been put in place,
right.
We don't know what they're going to look like. We don't know exactly what the test is going to test. We have no idea at this point in time whether or not the test will be given in March or April or May, will include all of the standards, a part of the standards, how many standards. So it's hard for me to sit here and say, is it fair or not fair? Because I need to look at the assessment. I need to put my eyes on the assessment and see the kinds of things we're expecting students to be able to know and be able to do, and how we're going to assess it. Is it multiple choice? Is it short answer? Is it essay? Those kinds of things.
Betty, just quick, do you think it's fair?
I think it's fair to hold teachers accountable. I don't know that holding them accountable using a test score is part of that. Certainly a test score informs instruction. You know, we all look at test scores, and I think Kelly would agree, and we look at the areas that are indicated as weak by the scores for our students, and we say, okay, now I need to do this different, I need to do that different. I maintain that a test score never made me change my practice, never made me teach differently. What I taught might have been different, but not how I taught. So from my personal perspective, the important part of the evaluation process for a teacher is not a test score. It's in the best practices. Are you using best teaching practices? Because if you are, chances are your students are going to achieve.
Don, if I may follow up, I think the other important point is, will the assessment inform instruction? As an example, right now the school systems administer what's called the MSA in the state of Maryland. We give that test somewhere around the second or third week of March, and we receive those results somewhere around mid-June. So consequently, it's very difficult for that particular test or that assessment to really inform instructional practices and to really give in-depth feedback to teachers. So part of it is, the question for me is, will the PARC assessment provide a true picture of how our students are doing and inform instructional practice and help teachers? That is, will the assessment be reliable? Will it be valid? And will we get timely results that are specific down to the item? In other words, will we have an item analysis so if I'm a teacher in a classroom, I can look the week after my students take the assessment and say, oh, here my students did fantastic, and here there's a weakness, so now I have some time to help those students before the end of the school year gain those necessary skills that they need to be successful in the following year. So I think we have to decide, the state has to decide, whether or not the PARC assessments are going to be an instructional tool, or are the PARC assessments going to be a political tool.
Kelly, it seems to quickly, do you think it's fair?
Well, I think most teachers would tell you they don't mind being held accountable, But under the current circumstances, my personal opinion is no, it is not fair.
So how do we stack up in terms of standardization in terms of testing, right? We want one of those kids to know certain basic things. How does that impact teaching? I mean, and then the old Child Left Behind and even previous testing, it was you taught to the test. That's what you do, and then that way you can show that you're accountable and you're actually raising the scores and so on, rather than the critical thinking issue, which is apparently part of this. And how does providing all that information, or making sure the students learn that information, fit in with critical thinking? And how do you assess critical thinking? I mean, in a standardized test, I mean, how do you do it, John? I'm sure I'm throwing up fastballs, but that's okay. He's looking at me.
I'm not a test creator. I'm not a psychometrist, so I can't respond to the question you're asking. Yeah. But I think it's important for everyone to understand that the Common Core will provide two areas of assessment. The Common Core standards are in two areas. One is language arts, which includes reading, writing, and communication skills, grammar skills, those kinds of things. And the other is in the area of mathematics. So the Common Core is two sets of standards. That will be assessed through either the PARC or Smarter Balance. Since I'm not a psychometrist, I can't respond to the how do test creators or test designers create tests or assessments that really assess whether or not a student can think critically or really truly knows and understands. But in the United States of America, we have a long history of testing and using that to make assessments. As an example, the SAT. I took the SAT. I'm looking around the room, and I think some other people are smiling. They also took the SAT. And that test score in my day determined whether or not I entered my first choice college, my second choice college, or my third choice college, as well as scholarships and those kinds of things. So the United States of America, right or wrong, good or bad, we have a long history of assessment. I think right now, as I said before, we're waiting to see what the PARC assessment is going to look like. Is it going to be 4 days of tests? Is it going to be 2 days of tests? Is it going to be 2 hours long, 1 hour long? What accommodations will we be able to make? Kelly talked about special needs children. Will we be able to make accommodations for special needs children in the protocols for administering the tests or the assessments? Will we not? So those things are still being decided at the state level. But Don, you make an excellent point, and the question I think we all ask ourselves as parents and as educators, does the test drive instruction?
Patty, I think ran across an explanation as to, I think it was Lillian Lowry, as a matter of fact, superintendent, who said that basically there'll be fewer standards so that there would be greater ability to get more deeper into the subject. I think that's how she described it. First of all, what does that mean, I guess, for a teacher anyway? And second, how does it fit together with trying to figure out whether or not you can think critically or not? I mean, and you've been in the classroom. I mean, I know this is a tough one.
Well, you know, I referenced earlier the mile wide versus a half a mile wide, right, and the depth being 4 inches versus 4 feet. Part of what I think it is, and I'm not in the classroom right now, so I have to rely on Kelly and others who are. But for example, in science, there's a very basic process that students learn for solving problems in science. It's called the scientific method. And once you learn the process, you should be able to use that process to solve any problem, even if it's not a science problem. So I'm guessing that we're teaching students not just content that they can spit back at us, but we're teaching them processes by which they can decode information, interpret it, form opinions on it, argue it, and do all the things that make them more credible in their responses. I can't imagine that just learning content and being able to bubble in something or fill in a blank or write a sentence to respond to a question is really a good way to assess a student. So I think critical thinking and problem solving are things you can teach people to do, and then they can apply those skills to whatever they're learning.
Kelly, what do you think? I mean, I heard the idea that it's not enough for a student in these tests or whatever to answer correctly, but then they have to show how they got there, right? I mean, I think that's one of the things that's, as opposed to simple memorization. What do you think about that? How do you fit that together? And I don't know what you do for special needs. I mean,
Well, I do have a different perspective because I'm not a content master. I'm a support master, meaning I look at those IEPs and go into the classroom and try to assist the teacher to, you know, get those concepts through based on IEP goals and accommodation. So, you know, in terms of content, I'm not going to be the strongest one to be able to tell you that because I work in a variety of different contents throughout the day. I would say that, yes, it is designed to allow the student to be an innovative thinker, to, you know, have a little more freedom in terms of how they come to answers and, you know, derive conclusions and things like that. Now, with the park, my question is, how do you reflect that on an online assessment? We have seen samples because we are preparing to field test the park assessment in the spring, near the end of the school year. So, you know, we really don't have a lot of answers in terms of, you know, as Betty has stated, you know, how is this going to turn out? I would say that, you know, for teachers, it is challenging to adopt these new methods of teaching. And like we said, we're very unsure of how this is going to reflect when the actual assessment comes out.
Now, some people have made the observation that kids are now being asked to learn things at a much earlier age than, say, that they were before. That what I might have, say, read as say a fifth grader, now you're looking at third grade, for example. Is that true, Betty? What about that? And does this Common Core testing reflect an increase in the standard?
It reflects an increase in the rigor, and yes, some things are being taught in earlier grades, which is another concern we have because students who are in fourth grade now going to fifth grade, there's currently information in the fifth grade that is going to be moved to fourth grade. So when these students in fourth grade move to the fifth grade, that material will be gone. It will be moved back a year, and these students will have missed it. So I think, you know, those are some of the concerns we have. Kelly's right. How do you reflect this in an online test? It is going to be an online test. There is going to be one part that is more essay-oriented where they actually write out answers, but there's still a lot of multiple-choice type stuff. And that brings a whole other issue in because recently the State Department released a technology report, and it clearly showed that most of our districts do not feel technologically prepared to give these tests. There were over $100 million in monies that districts said they would need to bring their technology up to snuff. And several of them said they don't think they'll be ready for 3 or 4 years. So if we're giving the test, piloting this year and doing it for real next year, how does that impact what we're doing?
Well, let me, as a matter of fact, since talking about technology, I ran across a quote from the Maryland Superintendent of Schools, Lillian Lowry. And she was trying to reassure Governor Martin O'Malley that you would be on track. And O'Malley said, according to his account, how much of this is an IT challenge and how much of this is a testing and education challenge? And Lauer eventually said, it's testing, not IT. Betty, as somebody who's like on the ground and who talks to teachers all the time, how much of it is a testing problem and how much of it is an IT? Because there are some districts where they expect to invest millions of dollars in computers and so on just to get this thing going.
Well, you're talking about schools that don't have devices for every student, that are going to have to get devices. They're going to have the broadband or the bandwidth or whatever you call it to operate those devices. You're going to have to teach students. Now, I know we talk about kids being so technologically savvy, right, but they text and they, you know, play games, they do that. Now they're going to be asked to do writing, editing, and that sort of thing. A few months ago, I was in a school in Anne Arundel County, and I asked the media specialist, I said, so are you ready for next year with it? And she said, absolutely not. She said, we're still trying to teach some of our students, and these were elementary students, how to log in. You know, there are just problems they're not new problems, but they're problems that our students didn't necessarily deal with before that now they're going to have to deal with. They're not accustomed, many of them, yet to taking online tests. Now, we do give some online tests, but not to the degree that we're going to be giving them. So, you know, I remember my dad telling me once, when a new model car comes out, don't buy it the first year, because that's where they find out where all the kinks and problems are, and then a year or two later they've got it all worked out. And I think we're going to find that as we move to all this new stuff. Does that mean it's bad? No. But should we be cautious as we go through this? Absolutely, because we're going to run into some bumps and some potholes and things along the way, and I don't want our students to suffer, and I certainly don't want our educators to suffer.
John, as a former superintendent, you obviously had to oversee technological changes, bring in computers, that kind of thing. How difficult is that? And, I mean, it's obviously difficult to project out what kind of impact this is going to have. But, I mean, how difficult is it for a school to begin to adapt and to bring not only the equipment in, which obviously costs money, but then to teach the teachers how to use it and then ultimately the students?
Well, there's a significant cost involved, as Betty was talking about. First, there's the whole broadband internet cost and setting up that whole system of broadband internet, high-speed accessibility. Certainly, the Shore Broadband Initiative has helped. Secondly, there's the actual devices and user devices that the students will use at some point in time. And thirdly is the staff development and training for teachers to help them better utilize the technology and equipment. So it is expensive. And the other thing is, we all know, as soon as you buy a piece of technology, it's out of date. So consequently, technology is always changing, constantly updated, and it's a significant cost to local school systems. I can remember when I first began as superintendent of schools, we were using Minnesota Consortium Apple IIe computers way back in 1996, and we would set up a computer lab in each of the elementary schools, and of course, now that has significantly changed with everything that has happened. Certainly technology is a great teaching tool, but technology will never replace the teacher. So for me, it comes down to the teacher investing, building capacity in the teacher, helping the teacher being able to utilize technology, not only for eventually an online assessment the students will take, but to use technology each and every day.
So when the Superintendent Lauer says it's the testing, it's not IT, do you think that's true?
I'm not sure in what context the state superintendent was remarking or responding to the governor's question. So it's difficult for me to give a clear response. But as you heard the conversation, you need both. You need the technology available, because these tests will be online. As I said before, one of the issues with the MSA assessments is they were paper and pencil tests, so we never received the results until 6, 8, 9 weeks later, and consequently it was almost too late to do anything with the assessment results that we received. By going to an online assessment, hopefully we'll get results back sooner and faster, so we can utilize those to inform instruction. And I think the overall question, too, we have to talk about is what's best for the kids, the students. Is paper and pencil best? Is this assessment best? Is online best? So what information do we need to provide to inform our students on how well they're doing, and more importantly, their parents? So in terms of technology, technology is a great tool. In terms of the testing situation, assessment situation, it can help us provide faster feedback, but then it presents the challenges of what we talked about today, which is, again, the broadband, the devices being used, the capacity and staff development, as well as helping the children learn keyboarding skills. I don't know about you folks, but I can remember sitting in typing class way, way back upon a time with my old
Underwood.
Well, I think Olympia or Underwood. I can't remember which one it was. Doing ASDFGHJKL semicolon.
Yep. Right.
And so consequently, we have to teach students, children, keyboarding skills. And please also, I think it's important for listeners to know, we have a technology gap. Some students come from families that are rich in technology. some students come from families that technology is not available. Maybe technology is a cell phone, but they don't have internet access. They don't have those kinds of things. So we do have a technology gap that is a tremendous challenge for schools to address.
Betty, what about that technological gap? As teachers are in the classroom, how do they deal with that? And as we move towards something that's even more sophisticated than ever before, I mean, how do you deal with that changing environment? And how do you deal with a technological gap in the classroom?
It's a challenge when you have students who come from homes that are rich in technology. They come to school, they already have a leg up on other students. And then you have and they can go home at night and they can search the internet and they can do all of that sort of thing with regard to their studies. And then you have the students who don't have those advantages. And they come in and they're just behind. They're behind because they haven't had those advantages. It's almost akin to years and years ago before all this technology, when you had children who came from homes where there were lots of books and lots of stimulation. And then you had children who came from homes where there was very little, if any. There was a huge difference from, you know, point A to point B in terms of these kids' progress. So it is a challenge. We deal with gaps all the time. We deal with achievement gaps. We deal with the technology gaps. We deal with poverty, which has a huge impact on students. And now with the sequestration and the most recent economic downturn, we have more and more children who are coming from homes of that are struggling and are moving into poverty. So it's going to be a lot to deal with for teachers.
Kelly, how does all this talk about technology impact particularly the kids that you teach, special needs kids? How integral is technology for them, and how, in terms of its use for this particular program, will it have an impact at all, or how what do you see the future here?
Well, I think you have to consider technology, its availability for instruction, and as a use for an assessment. I know my Comico County, part of our teacher evaluation is the use of technology. So if you have, you know, we have to incorporate technology into our lessons. So you have to ask yourself, well, if one school doesn't have the technological capabilities that another school has, then how are the students in that county getting equal access and equal opportunity for the same type of education than, you know, a school that doesn't have it? So you have to consider those factors as well. Now, you know, when you look at, I work with high school students, and every high school student knows how to use their cell phone.
Right.
And, you know, most of them are more computer literate than maybe some younger students, just because computers have been in schools ever since they have entered. But you do have to consider that piece. All of our schools in Wicomico County are not ready for an online assessment, and it's going to cost a lot of money for the school system to prepare them for that. At the same time, you have teachers that are accountable for using technology, and so, like I said before, you have to consider the equal access and the differences between schools with technology.
Well, do you think that, there's an observation that's been made, which is that we've been a nation of readers for a very, very long time, and one of the observations about the new technology is that we're becoming now a nation of writers as well. That is because we write all the time. Whether it's, I mean, everything obviously from text messages, sometimes to blogs, sometimes our Facebooks. I mean, more and more people are beginning to write just because there's this accessibility and it's something that's in vogue. As a matter of fact, the observation was made that the golden age of letter writing, for example, it really wasn't all that golden because people maybe received maybe a letter or two every week, you know, if they were good at all. So what do you think, and I'll throw this to you, Betty, what do you think about the idea? Do your teachers see students becoming more engaged with writing than before, is there any impact, or is it just pretty much the same? Even though they seem to be writing more, whether it's 100 some odd characters or the blogs.
Yeah, I think it depends on the type of writing they're doing. You know, when they send text messages, they often use symbols and shortcuts and things like that, which, while it is a form of communication, I'm not sure I would classify it as real writing. And if they transfer that to an answer on a test, I'm not sure how far that's going to get them. So I think, you know, I am encouraged that people are writing more, because I think writing is an extension of thinking. It's just putting it on paper. But I think we have to be careful that our students are taught the appropriate way to communicate it on a more sophisticated level.
And one of the things that struck me, the education system has taken a lot of criticism over the years, and we've obviously had some recent stats where the United States didn't do so well in terms of other students internationally, although there are some problems with that test because, like, some areas, for instance, China, for example, took a very small group of students who actually are doing well and are well-funded as opposed to, say, the broad brushstroke of the United States. In Maryland, for example, Lillian Lowry said that 57%, there's a 57% rate in Maryland for students taking remedial courses upon entering college. And I guess you said, I'll start with you, John. Do you think, is the educational system in the United States as in dire shape as sometimes we're led to believe?
I think the public education, pre-K to 12, is doing a wonderful job providing high-quality education under very challenging circumstances. We're very fortunate that we have absolutely terrific teachers who every day are working hard to do everything they can. We have great school leaders, school system leaders, who every day are working hard to prepare our students for a world we can only imagine. What we're really talking about today is what are we doing to prepare the class of 2027? That's our current kindergarten. What curriculum do we have to have in place? What standards do we have to have in place to make sure those students are college and career ready for a world that we can only imagine what the world will be like in 2027 and what skills and knowledge they will need to be able to have in order to be successful in that world. And I want them to be successful because that's my Social Security payment. So they absolutely need to be successful because I'm planning on living for a long time and they need to pay my Social Security. So school systems are being phenomenally successful. We have more students attending college. We have more students graduating from college within time period. We have more students being prepared to go into the world of work and be successful in the world of work. We have a great generation of young people in teaching and working at the university. I have the opportunity to work with some phenomenal students, and they're doing a great job. And the reason those students are doing a great job at the university level is because pre-K to 12 teachers are making a difference every day in the lives of the children they touch and teach.
Betty, what about you, this picture that we have? I mean, and certainly in the poor areas, of course, there is an issue. How are students doing? I mean, obviously you advocate for teachers and no one, but are we lagging behind in other places, like, for instance, China or even Japan or Korea, where education seems to be, you know, I mean, that's in the forefront. They take these tests, they study more, they spend more hours studying from, you know, I mean, what's your assessment?
I think when you look at those statistics, you have to be careful because in China, they may only test a certain group of kids. In some countries, they may only educate certain children. In the United States, we educate everybody who walks through our doors. We try to give everybody equal opportunities. You also have to account, I think, for cultural differences. You know, I remember I went to public schools all my life, and half of my school career I was in Dodd schools, Department of Defense schools, because I was an Army brat.
Hmm.
I graduated from high school in Germany, and I remember way back then, the salutatorian and valedictorian were both Asian.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in my house, my parents had an expectation for me and my two brothers that we were going to achieve at whatever level we were capable of achieving. And nothing less was acceptable. I think if in an Asian household or another household where expectations are set, students meet those expectations, high or low. And so I think that if we account for differences in student populations, differences in cultural populations, we're going to find that the U.S. is doing a phenomenal job. And I also read recently where our ranking is really, it hasn't changed over the last several decades. I mean, people are highlighting it right now, but that's where it's been. And our students do well. Now, can we do better? Absolutely. Are we trying to? Yes. Do we want to make sure we do it right in Maryland? Yes. So I think we have to continue to move forward. We have to continue to provide opportunities for educators to become better, to get the professional development and the resources they need to do the job they need to do so that our students will achieve. But do I think our schools are doing, our teachers are doing well in our schools? I do.
Kelly, what about, have we come a long way in terms of special needs, in terms in the particularly the public system, what you've seen, or what's your sense about that?
Well, in terms of special needs students, yeah. You know, it's hard to say right now, being this is the first year in the new curriculum. Hmm. However, some people would perceive the, you know, like Betty had said earlier, what kids are learning in fifth grade, they may learn in fourth. So you have to ask, you know, did the curriculum and meet the needs of the students? Did the student gain skills? Did the student advance in their knowledge? And one obstacle we have is that, you know, students in high school, per se, there's no lower level math classes to put them in to help them strengthen those basic skills that they do need. But yet they're placed in situations where require those basic skills to in order to do higher levels of thinking. So that is a gap. I would like to go back to the other question about how the United States compares to other countries. And I think Betty is absolutely right in the sense that, you know, the biggest difference between America and other countries is that we do educate everyone. And that does play a major factor and a major role. However, some educators would say that the United States places emphasis on the wrong areas, and they funnel a lot of money into the wrong areas, such as testing and what you do with that testing. Now, you take a country like Finland has been in the news over the past few years, and you know they make sure their teachers are ready. They make sure they have the materials that they need, and the teachers are seen as respected professionals. And I think until the United States values education and makes it a top priority for the future of our country, you know, we're going to continue to have challenges. But we have to have that united feeling that education is important, and it's extremely vital to the success of the future of our country.
In about the minute and a half we have so far, John, do you think that we put enough emphasis, enough resources into creating good teachers?
No.
And what do you think that is?
I think it's a historical perspective. I think in the United States, some people believe that anyone can teach. But both Kelly, Betty, and I know that teaching is a calling that requires a tremendous amount of skill, knowledge, and ability to truly and deeply understand the learning process, and a passion to make a difference. I think those are the keys. I think one of the things that, in terms of addressing that issue, we look at teacher salary and pay. In terms of professionals, teachers are one of the lowest paid groups in the United States of America. And as Kelly was pointing out, in Finland, they're the highest paid group in the country. So the whole question of investing in teachers and investing, we want the best and brightest to be in our classroom. And I think the question we have to ask, and Kelly was asking this question, how do we go about it in the United States making sure that the best and the brightest people end up working with our greatest resource, which is our children?
We've been speaking with John Andes. He's an instructor in Education Specialties Department at Salisbury University. Also, Kelly Stevenson with the Wicomico County Education Association, and Betty Weller, who's president of the Maryland State Education Association, talking about the issue of the Common Core, which is now being implemented as standards. And we'll take a look and see how, as we go along, how that works out. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.